It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And coming up a little bit later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the Farm Bill. I'm Jean Purcell. Right now, last month, the Supreme Court overturned the Defense of Marriage Act. The court also ruled that the activists who were defending California's anti-gay marriage Proposition 8 did not have standing to defend the law in federal courts. The LGBT community is celebrating these rulings as steps towards marriage equality.
Now, this is a huge change in American law. 17 years ago, Congress passed the Defense of Marriage Act by large veto-proof majorities. And since that time, lots have changed, and including the way LGBT characters and relationships are shown in popular culture. In 1996, there weren't very many openly gay characters, and now we've got Glee, we've got Modern Family and Game of Thrones, and the list just keeps going on.
Do you think that pop culture has changed the same-sex marriage debate in the United States? Did television shows or the movies influence your beliefs about gay people? And if so, how? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 to tell us why. And you can also email us. That address is talk@wpr.org.
Wired culture reporter Angela Watercutter is the author of How Pop Culture Changed the Same-Sex Marriage Debate, and she's here to talk about how TV, movies, and even comics have helped to shape this national conversation. Angela, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what's changed, you know, in the last, let's say, 20 years about how gay people are depicted on TV and in pop culture?
Well, I think for one, it's sort of even a question of volume. I mean, if you talk about 10 years ago, there were maybe, you know, a handful of characters here and there. And every time a new one came, it was sort of like this big deal. Like it, you know, made headlines. It got a lot of traction. And now it seems like more and more, almost every show, every movie, you know, has at least one LGBT character and, you know, has maybe an LGBT issue that gets discussed. So it's really sort of become a thing of it's more commonplace now. And because of that, I think the sort of larger conversations that get had about political issues like, say, Prop 8 or, you know, DOMA or things like that, you know, people have reference points. They can see things, you know, in TV and, you know, in the books they read and on, you know, and even in music where they, you know, kind of have interactions with LGBT people in their lives. And I think that that just sort of gives them something to inform these larger political discussions that happen.
Now, when we look at the history of gay characters on TV, I think one of the watershed moments was when Ellen DeGeneres came out on our TV show. This was a sitcom, yeah. Ellen. I think it was kind of loosely autobiographical, not her current variety show, but her character, Ellen, came out. And we have a clip of that. Let's take a listen.
This is so hard, but I think I've realized that I am... I can't even say the word. Why can't I say the word? I mean, why can't I just say... I mean, what is wrong? That why do I have to be so ashamed? I mean, why can't I just say the truth? I mean, be who I am. I'm 35 years old. I'm so afraid to tell people. I mean, I just... Susan, I'm gay.
And there was that watershed clip. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember. It was, what, 1997? I was probably 17, so I was watching in my family's living room when that happened. And, you know, I remember everything that happened around it, too. She was on the cover of Time with that, you know, Yep, I'm Gay cover. You know, it was sort of, like you said, it was sort of autobiographical in that, you know, both of those things were sort of happening at the same time. And, people talked about it for weeks.
Yeah, people talked about it. It was a big deal. And then you flash forward 15 years or so, and it's completely commonplace. You don't have to have these big revelations. The characters just are what they are.
Yeah. Well, and Ellen personally, you know, I mean, now everybody knows she's married to Portia de Rossi. She was actually married before Prop 8. And then, you know, they kind of went through the whole rigmarole that, you know, happened, you know, legally with that case after the fact. And so, you know, it's life imitating art and back and forth now.
Now, how do you think it influenced people? I mean, do we have real evidence for that, or is it just sort of anecdotal based on what we see on TV?
I mean, I think a lot of it is anecdotal, but, you know, GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, did a study actually in 2008 where they, you know, they polled folks and asked them, you know, whether or not their opinions had changed. And, you know, I think 20% of them, or like 2 in 10 of them, had said that they had, you know, more favorable, you know, opinions of LGBT people. And some of what they were saying was influencing them was that they knew a character on television or they knew a character in film. They may not know one in real life, but, you know, having seen a story in a film or on television had kind of given them a more informed idea of, you know, what LGBT people were and, you know, how they how they might impact their lives.
Now, even Joe Biden seemed to indicate at one point that part of the reason the Obama administration got behind marriage equality was because of the way popular culture was moving.
Yeah, he was quoted in a somewhat famous interview. I think it was like on Meet the Press or something like that, you know, where he talked about Will and Grace, you know, and he was saying like that just became, he wasn't even talking so much about the administration. He was talking about people in general, like they had all watched Will and Grace. They, you know, kind of had, you know, welcomed the gay characters on that show into their living rooms. And, you know, it influenced this broader discussion. And, you know, it was sort of funny that Big Joe would put it that way, but that's what he did.
You know, when you think about the pop culture we're talking about, and probably, you know, there's music too, but we're kind of largely talking about TV and these sitcoms that kept having gay characters, getting them out there, from Ellen to Will and Grace, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, on and on like that. You're talking about Hollywood, the Hollywood community. So how much of the attention here goes to the writers who push these characters?
I mean, I think they should be given a lot of credit for creating these characters. You know, it's something, it's not easy to do. I mean, anytime you're trying to translate real life into something that can fit in a half an hour or an hour container, it's, you know, it's not always the easiest thing to nail down. But, you know, I think over time, as you know, it kind of becomes self-perpetuating, right? You know, like we'll have like sort of like the token gay character or something who's just the guy in the office who makes funny quips, and then it goes further and further. And now you have like Modern Family, where there's, you know, there's a gay couple that is, you know, central to the story and has real problems and is raising kids and, you know, like kind of has all those things. And I think credit goes to the writers of those shows for actually portraying, you know, LGBT characters as they, you know, as they are in real world scenarios and not just, you know, kind of they're offering a funny joke or something like that. So, yeah.
Do you think it was a conscious effort on behalf of certain writers, or do you think it's just what happened?
I mean, I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think writers in general want to be able to tell stories that people can relate to. And as, you know, they look around and see, you know, more and more gay characters in their lives, you know, that becomes something that translates into what they do. But I think there probably is a little bit of a, I don't know if activist is the right term, but a little bit more of an agenda kind of that goes into those things. I remember when, it's funny, when right before Prop 8 passed, I think, here in California, the movie Milk had just come out. And about a year later, the writer of that movie, Dustin Lance Black, won an Oscar for writing it. And I think he made a couple comments in his speech about, you know, about Prop 8 and, you know, needing it to be overturned and how, you know, sort of, how these things sort of affected young people and things like that. So I think, you know, I mean, I think in those regards, these things really do sort of play out on a lot of different levels.
Now, recently, Jay-Z came out with public support of the LGBT community. And there's also the other top 40 rapper, Macklemore, who's famous for that song, Thrift Store. But he's also got a song in favor of marriage equality. It's called Same Love. And let's listen to a clip of that one.
Progress march on, with the veil over our eyes, we turn our back on the cause, till the day that my uncles can be united by law, when kids are walking around the hallway, plagued by pain in their heart, a world so hateful some would rather die than be who they are, and a certificate on paper isn't gonna solve it all, but it's a damn good place to start.
No law is a little bit of Macklemore there, and his song, and Angela, what do you make of that song?
I mean, I think it's a really touching thing, and it's surprising that, you know, hip hop has kind of come this far that there would even be a song like that. I don't know that many people would have imagined something like that 10 years ago when, you know, we were talking about, you know, Eminem's lyrics and things like that that were, you know, kind of perceived as homophobic. It's interesting there. I read I think it was a Reddit thread about that song not too long ago, where a teacher in Canada had said that his students had played that song for him because he was out to them and he had a partner and they were, you know, they wanted to show support. So the kids played that during a class session, you know? So, I mean, these things kind of do resonate, I think, in ways that we don't even necessarily expect in the beginning.
We're talking to Wired reporter Angela Watercutter about how LGBT characters in pop culture have influenced the same-sex marriage debate. And what's your experience with that? Have you changed your mind based on what you've seen in pop culture, in music, in song, on TV, and in movies? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about how pop culture influences same-sex marriage debate, and we're taking your calls right now. Do you think gay characters on TV or in the movies made a difference in this debate? Why or why not? Do they make a difference with you or somebody that you know? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. I'd also be curious to know if you thought that Hollywood got it right when it came to portraying gay characters. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. And we're with Angela Watercutter now, the culture reporter for Wired Magazine. And let's go to our first call. This is Chris with us in Kenosha. Hey, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How about you?
Wonderful, thank you. My comment was my daughter, I just started to allow her to download songs on her own. She'll be 13 in a month. I told her, unless, you know, something comes up funny. But her first download was that song by Macklemore. And as a parent, I couldn't have been prouder of her. But to comment on your question as far as how I feel Hollywood depicts the LGBT community, they're really the only experience that I've seen really of, or that I've had experience with in that situation would be a TV show, and I thought it was not portrayed very well. And I can't think of the TV show, but I think as time goes on, things will get better.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for that perspective, Chris. And Chris, her daughter, had a song, you know, that was in support of marriage rights, but she wasn't always sure about the way Hollywood portrayed gay people. And I suppose that's evolved over the time. What do you think, Angela?
Yeah, I think it definitely has. You know, as I mentioned earlier, it's, you know, there used to sort of be, you know, the LGBT characters, you know, movies and TVs were kind of stereotypical. You know, they sort of played on, you know, on sort of other people's perceptions of LGBT characters. But I feel like over time it has gotten better. I don't think it's probably not, you know, perfect by, you know, anybody's estimation. But it's, you know, I mean, it's the same thing with, I think, the portrayals of a lot of minorities in media. You know, it kind of takes time for, you know, culture to learn and evolve and get there. And, you know, I like the caller said, you know, we're moving on. We're getting there.
All right. Thank you, Chris. And we move to another Chris. This Chris is in Madison. Hey, Chris.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, I agree that Hollywood is, the portrayal of gay people in Hollywood is creating maybe an unhealthy stereotype that may be hard for gay people to live up to because that's all they see.
Even today, you think this?
Yeah. Definitely.
Who do you point to a character that you think is a stereotype?
I would say Modern Family, the couple in Modern Family, and Will and Grace, of course. Mm-hmm. It's just the whole always happy, facetious, loud, friendly, and that's just not true. You know, they're regular people. Very could be very quiet. Could be anything really. And if that's all we see on TV, then it's not going to be healthy, I don't think.
Great. Well, thanks for your thoughts, Chris. And he's obviously thinking that it's time to evolve, move on past just having gay families on TV, but evolve how we portray gay people as just people. What's your take, Angela?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think there have been other portrayals, you know, that aren't always so shiny happy. You know, there was the whole bullying storyline on Glee, you know, a couple seasons ago with talking about, you know, high school students, you know, getting harassed in school and what that means. So, you know, it's not that they're always necessarily all shiny, happy kind of couples and things like that. But it is true. But the other thing I think that comes into play is that television is always, you know, kind of life cranked up to 11. You know, like there's that there's a little bit of the where, you know, I don't think probably every heterosexual who watches, you know, TV or movies is like, yes, that looks exactly like my life. You know, like there's a lot of things like that, you know, kind of come into play and are, you know, sort of an influence on what happens on the screen.
Okay, another caller now. We go to Dick joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Dick.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Very, very interesting show.
Thanks.
And as far as television, the media influencing my thoughts on homosexuality, no, it hasn't changed. I do feel very strongly that it's just another step in the decline of the morality of this country when it you know, the pop culture, so to speak, is influencing people to a degree that they think that it's okay for two men or two women to get married. I think culture, you know, the society, every culture or society that has gone that way has disappeared from pretty much the face of the earth, and it still is the wrong thing to do. I mean, even if a person didn't believe in the truth of the Bible, it still is biologically it would never ever work. I mean, we would not have a population in a few hundred years.
So, Dick, do you just when you see gay people on TV and in music, do you sort of tune that out and hold to your beliefs, or how do you process it?
Oh, I just turn it off, and I just hope and pray that my children and my grandchildren are doing the same. And I know. I mean, I have friends, I have acquaintances that have chosen that lifestyle, and I just feel bad that they've chosen that way.
Well, let's get Angela in on this, and here we have Dick, who's firm in his beliefs about homosexuality.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, that's sort of that's democracy. You can choose to, you know, listen to or be influenced by the things you watch, or you can choose not to listen to them. I mean, I feel like that's just one person's choice over another.
And another call here. Jocelyn joins us from Sheboygan. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi. I grew up in Hollywood, California in the 50s and 60s and knew very, very varied people, and I've lived in Wisconsin for over 40 years, and I know two families with the same father, and the first family had a gay daughter, and the brother of that gay daughter has a gay daughter, and the second family of the same father also has a gay daughter. I've always thought, from knowing people growing up and really listening to people as I've tried to do all my life, they don't choose to be gay. It is not a lifestyle. I'm heterosexual, and I find nothing wrong with it. I think it's just a part of human sexuality. And living in 2013, to hear such ridiculous remarks as a lifestyle or you're going to hell if you are this way. It's just, you know, I just don't understand it.
All right. Thanks a lot for your comments, Jocelyn. We appreciate it. And here we had back-to-back two callers got their beliefs. Is Hollywood's portrayal, what we're talking about here in pop culture of the LGBT community, is it swaying the people in the middle and not the people at the ends?
Yeah, you're asking me?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it does sort of have one of those things where I think that people who feel strongly one way or the other, you know, or either kind of like at the 0 or 10 of the spectrum, you know, may not change. But I feel like, you know, as we see almost any time there's an election cycle, it's always the people in the middle that kind of decide one way, you know, which way an election is going to go or a decision is going to go. And so, you know, I think that probably I would imagine pop culture probably has its strongest, you know, its strongest influence on people who, you know, like I was saying before, who just maybe had never encountered an LGBT person before and like are able to through a film or through television or, you know, through a song and, you know, get influenced that way. And whether or not, you know, however way it chooses to influence them, whether they choose to support them or not, you know, that's neither here nor there. But it does probably have its greatest impact on folks that are kind of, you know, somewhere hovering around the center.
So I've got about a minute left, but I wonder if you could talk real quickly about the cultural conundrum going on with the Ender's Game movie adaptation. What's controversial about that?
So the Ender's Game movie is an adaptation of a book by Orson Scott Card, and Orson Scott Card has been fairly vocal in his views against same-sex marriage. And what's happened now is that there is a sort of an online call for folks to boycott the movie. So it doesn't even come out, I think, until November. So it'll have a while to see how long this kind of plays out, and if it ends up, you know, being detrimental to the film or not. We'll just kind of have to wait and see. But yeah, that's what's going on with that right now.
Anything else you're watching on this front as you're watching gay characters in pop culture?
Nothing particularly. It's, you know, like I said before, it's the volume of it, I think, is really what's sort of fascinating, is that, you know, the number of LGBT characters in media just kind of keeps growing. I mean, I was doing some research when I was looking into coming on your show today, and I there were so many that I hadn't even heard of yet. You know, it just seems like there's, you know, it's happening all over the place in a lot of different media. And, yeah, it's kind of almost hard to keep track of these days.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Angela. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Angela Watercutter, a culture reporter for Wired. And coming up, we'll talk to WPR's reporter based in Superior, Mike Simonson.
And we'll be talking with Mike about some of the latest activities in the controversial Gogebic taconite mine in northern Wisconsin. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up later on this half hour, we'll be talking with Wisconsin Public Radio Assistant News Director Noah Obshinsky about the Farm Bill, how it passed out of the House, and what its future looks like. In the meantime, we're going to be joined now by Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter based in Superior, Wisconsin, Mike Simonson. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Gene. Hi, Veronica.
We're going to be talking with Mike about some of the developments in the mining story that's been taking place up there. We heard a piece from Mike Simonson during our newscast a few seconds ago about Gogebic taconite. They've been drilling the last of 8 exploratory boreholes in the Pinoki Range up there, and that work could be finishing up pretty soon, but there have been some pretty big developments in the meantime. Mike, before we get to your interview, I want to play just a clip of some audio from what happened there this week.
Get on the other side and die! I hope you commit suicide.
You guys don't have a permit. I don't know what you're going
to do. You don't have a permit! You're not supposed to be here! You're breaking the law, you're destroying the water! The injunction, there's going to be a class action lawsuit. There's going to be an injunction. You're not supposed to be here!
And so there you have a very sort of vivid representation of what's been going on in the Northwoods this month and this week. Mike, you said earlier that WPR has been covering this mining story for the better part of a year or more. And now you say that the story this week is taking a turn. It used to be a debate, and now it's turned into something else.
Yeah, it's ratcheted up quite a bit. But, you know, from a news standpoint, this is an example of how pictures can really drive the news. The dramatic pictures of the bulletproof security guards with their assault weapons draped across their chest and in desert camouflage, and the audio you just heard from the June 11th raid on the drill site, which was the first day of drilling, when about 15 masked, wearing black protesters literally converged out of the woods on the camp, surrounded the workers. So it's, but again, that happened though a month ago. What happened this week was that was released, and it, I think, drove home the point of how intense this has been.
So let's talk about some of the reaction. First of all, where did that video, that audio come from? It wound up posted on YouTube or someplace?
Yeah, it was from a person who is against the mine, but very much for the LCO Harvest Camp, which is next to the proposed mining property. And this is a very peaceful camp, open to the public, where they harvest, they educate, they hunt, gather fish, and they're exercising their treaty rights. They just opened it in May. I've been there a couple of times. It's a pretty cool place with where they're really doing everything from harvesting birch bark to wild onions to go on fishing, and they plan to expand it so they can do some maple syruping. But, a lot is going on in that area that was peaceful, but now it's just gone up to a whole new level.
Yeah, and the reactions have been very interesting. Of course, we've had the reaction from Gogebic, but we've also had reaction from the Bad River Tribe Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, very much opposed to the mine, but also very much opposed to what they see as some of this violence going on.
Right, they don't want to be painted with the brush of those of the people who participated in the raid. By the way, one of those protesters goes to court. She'll have her initial appearance Monday afternoon in Iron County. But yeah, they are very determined legally and with civil disobedience to stop this mine, because they say that this is a genocide on their culture. And another thing that's going to happen next week is that the Chippewa Tribal Council, which is many tribes from the ceded territory of northern Wisconsin and perhaps northern Minnesota, are getting together at Red Cliff on Monday and Tuesday to discuss a lot of issues. And certainly this might top the agenda.
And meanwhile, those security guards that you talked about before, they've been pulled back, right? They're still awaiting permits?
Right. I'm being told by people who visit the drill sites that there is now another security firm without weapons, without camo, the T-shirt and shorts, and they're, you know, looking out after the workers. So somebody, there is, you know, like an interim team in there. But that whole thing was really bizarre, because if you look at the pictures, here are paramilitary security guards seemingly posing for these pictures with their, you know, with their assault weapons. And you would think that if they're going to, you know, be patrolling an area, they wouldn't be posing for a picture. But it's probably, a lot of people think, intimidation and to send a message. And so they were doing that. But what is even more curious, and Sean Johnson covered this for us, was how could they forget to apply for a license? I mean, this is an experienced, high-powered security firm from Scottsdale, Arizona, and oops.
Forgot to apply for the license.
Yeah, well, I thought you were going to get that.
No, I just took me a second to jump in on that. And I'm a little slow on my game today. So I have to ask you, through this all, what's the reaction of Göbek being? I mean, they are continuing the exploratory drilling. It is as much as business as usual as they can make it, it sounds like.
Right. I mean, they're obviously defending what they're doing. But I'll tell you what, behind the scenes, some of the people I'm talking to, I was doing a story about the LCO camp, which is being challenged for its legality, and that's another story I'm working on. It's by a statewide group. But the LCO chairman, Mick Isham, as well as the mayor of Mellon, Joe Barabee, I was just talking to them for some background, and they are angry because it's also these images that are coming out of the Northwoods are scaring off tourists, and they're finding cancellations, people saying, I'm not going to go up there if I'm going to walk in the woods and have ninja people or Rambos running around. So the background of all of this is kind of a traumatizing thing to the area, which is the way that Mike Wiggins described it. But GTAC is sticking by their guns, literally.
Yeah, and I wonder about that. I mean, does it seem as though, and it sounds like what I've been hearing you say, is that positions are hardening? I mean, the folks who are for the mine are more for it than they were. The folks who are against it are more against it. And it just seems as though tensions are ratcheting. I don't know if I want to say in an uncontrollable way, but from a distance, it's sort of what it looks like.
They did up the ante both sides up the ante with that raid on June 11th. But again, that was contrary to all the other protests that have happened. They've been walks, there have been marches, there have been debates and hearings. That was unusual, but it said it can happen. That was the point that made. But, I think what we're seeing is perhaps more pro-mining people offended by the pictures that are coming out of northern Wisconsin, because it's going to hurt their business, their resorts, and recreation. That was a PR nightmare, I think, for GTAC until the video was released on Wednesday, and then it switched sides and became, you know, the apologies were coming from the anti-mining people.
So now what's going to be happening next? You said in your piece that this work on the exploratory boreholes is going to be winding up pretty quick. So then what? GTAC remains on site. They go away? What?
Well, technically, they cap the holes. They've already done that for seven of the holes. They're on the eighth hole, so they won't have anything to guard. But the DNR tells me that they have expressed interest in drilling more holes, which would make sense then for them to bring back the bulletproof securities people, because there'd be something to guard. Otherwise, I can't really figure out what they'd be doing up there if there aren't crews. So I think the next step, we're going to see an application for a license to drill more exploratory holes. But probably the biggest thing looming is bulk sampling, which is mini mining, where they'll take like 10,000 tons of rock and blow it up. They'll be using explosives, and that'll take samples that the company and the DNR can look at for either dangerous things and also the quality of the iron ore that's in the ore body. And that is probably 60 to 90 days away, and in between there'll be a public hearing, and I can expect fireworks from that too.
Now, I hadn't heard of this explosion business before, so this will be taking place in the business or in the area where the boreholes are, or?
Yeah, it's, you know, like I say, it's 60 to 90 days away, contingent on the DNR approving it, and the DNR wants more information on that. But, you know, explosives in an explosive situation, and really the first practical mining would begin, albeit on a very small scale.
Well, Mike Simonson, sounds like you've got your work cut out for you the next couple of months. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's a team effort.
Mike Simonson, the Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Superior. He's been talking with us for the last few minutes about some of the events of the past week, the past months, in the Gogebic mining story taking place and some of the opposition to that proposed mine in northern Wisconsin. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up next, we'll talk to WPR's assistant news director, Noah Ovshinsky, about the week's top news stories from Wisconsin, including the Farm Bill passed last night in the House. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
The House passed the Farm Bill last night. It's vastly different legislation than the Senate passed earlier this year and leaves out a major part of what's made up farm bills in the past, things like food stamps. And here to break down how this story affects Wisconsin is Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director. Hey, Noah.
Hey, guys. Good afternoon.
So let's take a look at this farm bill that just left the House. How is it looking compared to what we saw out of the Senate?
Oh, well, depending on how you look at these things, the effort to pass a new farm bill either took a huge step forward or a huge step back, depending on where you come from. As you alluded to, the House yesterday, along a party line vote, passed a farm bill, although it was stripped of the food stamp program, which makes up about 80% of the farm bill program as far as money is concerned. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. And food stamps in the Farm Bill have been married, like literally married, since the early 1970s. And so the fact that the GOP leaders in the House decided to essentially separate the Farm Bill is a big deal.
So what happened there? Did you see that coming?
I actually didn't see this coming. I'm actually a little cynical about the passage of a farm bill when it's all said and done. The Senate has already passed the farm bill, and we've been waiting on the House to pass their version of the farm bill so the two can get together and work on legislation and then hopefully pass it. Because right now, the agriculture industry has been in limbo for a little over a year. Congress has not been able to pass a farm bill. And in addition to funding food stamp programs, the Farm Bill also establishes agriculture policy for the United States, including the dairy industry here in Wisconsin, which is crucial to our state. And so all of these stakeholders have been in limbo because the House has not been able to pass a Farm Bill. 2 weeks ago, the House attempted to pass a Farm Bill very similar to the one that has already passed the Senate. That failed. And so GOP leaders in the House felt like the only way they could get a Farm Bill passed is if they stripped the food stamps out of it, because the food stamps are the most controversial part of it. There are many budget hawks in the GOP who want to really steeply cut the food stamp program. There are other Republicans who don't want to cut it as much. And of course, Democrats don't want to cut it nearly as much as the Republicans. And so the food stamp issue remains a huge issue for the farm bill.
So you take the food stamps out, you've got a bill that passes the House. So that came out of it. But what's left in the bill?
Well, what's left in the bill is the agriculture policy that was largely set by the Senate. And basically what it does, and of course, this is a very long and complicated bill, but what it really begins to do is move our agriculture policy away from paying farmers whether or not they grow something, you know, as sort of a risk management tool. And that's been one of the things. We directly pay farmers whether or not they actually grow crops to keep them afloat. Well, now what we're doing is we're moving away from those direct subsidies, and now we're subsidizing insurance policies for farmers to help them keep them afloat if they say they have a crop failure or something like that, or prices for whatever reason plummet. So it's actually a sea change in the way that, from the federal government's perspective, the way that we manage risk on farms.
And so do you have a sense of how farmers are being affected by this now as we're in limbo on the farm bill in general? What's going on?
Right. Well, we're currently operating under the an extension of the last farm bill, which was technically the 2008 farm bill, which expired last year.
That would be 5 years ago.
Yes. In theory, we'd already have a new farm bill. In fact, right. In theory, we will have had a new farm bill for the last 10 months. But we don't. But we don't because it's Congress. And so what's interesting is it'll be very interesting to see moving forward how far the food stamp program goes, and really how far the farm bill goes, because there's no way the Senate and the House have to agree on this. There's no way that the Senate, led by the Democrats, are going to accept cuts to food stamps. There's just no way. So, you know, I think probably the GOP leadership saw this as a way to get a farm bill passed. But whether or not it actually becomes law is really unclear, because not only does the Senate have to agree to it, but President Barack Obama has also said that he's going to veto any farm bill that doesn't include money for food stamps. So when I say it's an uphill battle to pass a farm bill, that's actually an understatement.
It's a long road to be watching.
Long road.
Right. So in terms of the process.
Yeah.
What's going to happen next?
Well, yeah. So one of the things is the leadership in the House really wanted to get this thing passed very quickly, because the House is going to go into their month-long break pretty soon. And they want to pass this thing so that the legislation can be moved to the conference committee, where the Senate and the House come together to work out a compromise bill. They wanted to get that process started. And what will be interesting to see is if the farm bill that comes out of that conference committee, whether that will include food stamps or not. And that will largely determine whether or not we're going to have a farm bill anytime soon. It has to be said that if a farm bill isn't passed by November, we will revert back to agriculture programs that were around in 1949, which is just part of the farm bill every farm bill that's been passed in 30, 40 years have included this, that every time a farm bill, if it expires and Congress doesn't take action, then agriculture policy reverts back to the 40s. And that will largely mean higher prices on a lot of products.
It's not funny, except that it's absurd going back to 1949.
But
right?
It's Congress. So,
it's Congress. So I guess that's what we expect.
It is what it is.
Let's move on to another story that's been making news. The Regents met this week, and
yes.
This is the first official meeting since the new state budget passed.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, I think probably most importantly to a lot of residents here in Wisconsin, they formalized, I guess is the word for it, the freeze, the tuition freeze. And again, I don't know, just to sort of remind your listeners, the state lawmakers included in the new state budget that came into effect July 1st a provision that froze tuition. So it's not like the Regents really had any choice in the matter, but they formalized the fact that tuition is going to be frozen. But what they did, interestingly enough, that the state lawmakers didn't ask for is they broadened that freeze to include out-of-state and graduate students as well, not just undergrads. So
where does that gesture come from? Is that sort of their olive branch?
You know, I haven't seen a quote where somebody has said this is an olive branch, but reading between the lines, I think they felt like it was probably politically the right thing to do.
And so you're looking at what the total operating system of UW is something like $5.6 billion. You know, they had this $650 million budget surplus. So I guess they have to be figuring out, well, that wasn't okay. What number is okay for a rainy day fund?
Right. It was initially that surplus that really enraged state lawmakers. They found out that the UW had $650 million, most of which came from tuition dollars. And there were many lawmakers who were furious because they said, well, why does the UW have all this money, especially from tuition, at a time when they're asking students for more tuition every year? And that's where this whole effort to freeze tuition came from. And so I think the Regents and the UW system as a whole is really going to be taking the next year to figure out, okay, what is the appropriate amount of reserves for a university to have? Because, of course, universities, they have reserves. They have rainy day funds. I mean, that's common. But what we don't know is what's appropriate. And I guess at the end of the day, that'll be up to lawmakers. But I think the Regents have to come up with a number and say, here, this is what we think is appropriate.
And had none of this gone down with the legislature, they were proposing a tuition hike.
Yeah, a 2% tuition hike in each of the next 2 years.
So it's quite a change there.
A huge change.
And, you know, it's interesting that the state is required to have a rainy day fund, but the university has got to figure out where their sweet spot is.
Exactly. And they have, I think, until January, at least, to come up with that number. They have to come back to state lawmakers with that number.
And one last story you've been keeping an eye on. We saw this week that there's still fallout from the city of Milwaukee's decision to ignore a new state law that allows city workers to live outside Milwaukee. What's going on there?
Right. Well, debate continues over the legality of Mayor Tom Barrett and the Common Council's decision in Milwaukee to essentially ignore the new state law that gets away does away with those residency requirements. That has proved to be very controversial. So controversial, in fact, that the Milwaukee Police Union has filed a lawsuit this week challenging the mayor's stance on residency. And as we expected this to make its way in the courtroom, and it will.
Any sense why it's coming from the police association in particular?
Well, the residency requirements have always been very unpopular with police and fire. And of course, you know, Milwaukee isn't the only city to deal with this. A lot of cities, Minneapolis, Detroit, St. Louis, Baltimore, these are all cities that used to have residency requirements that over time have either been, eliminated or scaled back. And so really, Milwaukee is just the latest city to do that. And of course, the mayor sees it as a way of keeping neighborhoods stable. And the police union and other folks see this as really an attack on their decision to live wherever they want to live.
Explain a little bit about the keeping neighborhoods stable. So he wants people to stay in the neighborhoods they're in, not move out of Milwaukee, not leave the city.
Yeah, I mean, no mayor wants to see an exodus of people out of the city. Now, there's no guarantee that police and firemen en masse are going to be moving to the suburbs. I mean, we don't know that. But at least by getting rid of the residency requirement, you don't know. It's possible. And no mayor wants to see that many people leave their city.
Any sense of what's happened in these other cities, Minneapolis, Detroit, St. Louis, Baltimore, where they've done the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, they were all scaled back or eliminated. It also has to be said, though, that there are folks in public safety, including the mayor and others, who say that police and firemen should live in the city that they serve, that it, in fact, makes law enforcement much more effective, much more responsive, and more respectful of the neighborhoods that they deal with. So there are arguments, pros and cons, in this issue.
So it'll be interesting to see what people decide to do as this gets played out.
It's going to play out in the courts, that's for sure.
Well, Noah, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate having you here.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
We've been talking about the state news stories and the Farm Bill and how it affects Wisconsin with WPR state news reporter. You are the assistant news director, Noah Ovshinsky, and you'll be back next week to talk again.
Absolutely.
Coming up, we get a fantastic view of the stars through the eyes of one of Wisconsin's own, Maggie Turnbull, a freelance astrobiologist who works out of her own lab in Antigo. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.